You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across America, Europe, and all across the North American continent on Pacifica stations, all across America, Europe, and Africa on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to this program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome to our program. And a quick reminder, check out Bernie.org. It's my Bernie.org day. I really want people to check out Bernie's website and, see what he's up to. See what's going on there. Bernie.org. Anyhow, revolution. Revolution and Obama, for that matter. There is a battle going on right now in the Senate and the House. Actually, the House part of it. The House decided to go on vacation this week. So, it's the Jewish holidays. They're saying, well, we're going on vacation. We're just going to take the whole week off. But really what they're doing is they're playing out the same thing. Remember the FAA thing? Where the House passed this bill that said that, okay, we'll fund the FAA, but we're going to put a provision in there that's going to basically make it tough on the unions. And the Democrats in the Senate, keep in mind the House is controlled by the Republicans, the Senate's controlled by the Democrats. And the Democrats in the Senate said, oh, no, you don't. You know, we've got our own legislation, and they wrote it up and they sent it over to the House. And so what Boehner and Cantor did was they passed this, crummy piece of FAA legislation, sent it over to the Senate, and then went on vacation. And said, if you guys don't eat our lunch, if you don't eat this moldy bologna sandwich that we made for you, you will have no lunch. Because we're out of here. There's no one to debate with. There's no one to negotiate with. And the Senate had already passed a good FAA funding bill. The House just ignored it. Well, the exact same thing is playing out again, only this time it's FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. You got people in Pennsylvania, in Tennessee, in Missouri, in Florida, in Vermont. You got people all over this country who have down the Missouri River, who have suffered horribly, lost their homes. Can you imagine having your home hit by a flood? And you don't just lose the house. It's like I remember, because Louise and I lived literally in a river for 5 years, a river that in 92 or 96 had flooded to the point where people had to evacuate it. 96. Thank you, Jacob. Jacob was there at the time. I hadn't moved to Portland yet at the time. And so when you live in a circumstance where, a bad weather event could literally take out your house, or at least cause you to have to leave it for a while, you start thinking, what are my priorities? And it occurred to me, we've got this box of pictures that go back, for the 35 years we've been married, or 36 or whatever it is. And if those things were destroyed, they would be like gone forever. I remember when my mom died, sitting with my brothers going through all the photos that my parents had. And, laughing at some and literally crying over some. Can you imagine, though, in the United States right now, as we speak, there are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people who lost all their pictures. They didn't just lose a building that insurance can replace. They lost the papers that tell them who they have their mortgage with or what their insurance policy is. Do you know insurance companies? If you have life insurance, for example, on your spouse, and your spouse dies and you've got to show the policy, you've got to know who the company is. That's probably not such a big deal, because if you're continuing to pay into it, you'll figure that out eventually. But the pictures, right? The old DVDs, the old videotapes, the memories wiped out. And so these people are not just in physical distress. They're in emotional distress that most of us would find hard to imagine. And Eric Cantor and John Boehner, who have no problem whatsoever sending a couple of $1 billion a week to Iraq and Afghanistan to, quote, rebuild those countries, end quote. And yes, we are building schools and hospitals, and we even built a building that the Bank of Iran is using in Baghdad. Or we repaired it. He has no problem rebuilding those countries and not saying, you know, in order to pay for that, we've got to cut back on some military budget or something like that. But FEMA, if we're going to send $7 billion to FEMA, which is what the Senate wants to send, the House, the Democrats in the Senate, the House, Republicans, only $3 billion and change. If we're going to spend if we're going to give FEMA $3 billion and the states, you know, for emergency relief, Texas on fire, people's homes burned up again, all the pictures gone, all the memories gone, all the old letters. If we're going to do that, we've got to lay off a certain number of teachers. We got to cut a certain number of kids off Medicaid. Medicaid, by the way, is the principal funder of children's hospitals. You know, all across the United States right now, children's hospitals are experiencing a crisis because Medicaid is being cut by these guys. So they say, if you want to fund FEMA, we got to balance it by cutting Medicaid. So they sent this bill to the Senate. The House sent this bill to the Senate saying, we're going to cut this. And the Senate said, no way, we're not going to pass that. Here's our own bill. And they sent a bill to the House. And the House then sent a bill back to the Senate and said, no, final offer. This is it, and we're going on vacation. See you later. And they did that last week. This is the exact same way the FAA thing played out. And so the question we're going to see throughout the week, and, you know, frankly, I think this is going to be a very interesting thing to, you know, keep your eye on here, is will the Democrats in the House do like they did with the FAA and basically say, okay, you got us over a barrel. We're taking the political heat. The government itself will get shut down on Friday. FEMA could get shut down before that. We'll take the political heat and we'll go along with the Republican bill because the Republicans have, you know, they're sitting around their pools back in their districts. Sipping Mai Tais, John Boehner, you know, having his gin and tonic and a cigarette. They're having a good old time. But the people in the Senate, they got to figure out what to do. Or will the Senate pass a bill again or simply walk away from what's there in the House? Will the senators simply say, you know, John, Eric, we sent you a bill. $7 billion for FEMA. You don't need offsets to pay for Iraq and Afghanistan. You shouldn't have to have offsets to pay for FEMA. Screw it. Pass our bill. And to a large extent, it's going to depend on how the media plays this, not just how the Democrats and Republicans play it. And so far, the media has been playing it that the Democrats are holding this thing up because they won't sign the Republicans' House bill. Very, very interesting. So I want to talk about revolution right after this, an American revolution.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the revolutions we've had in the past and how we may be at a revolutionary moment right now.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds small. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like...
Okay, there are revolutionary moments in American history. We obviously had one in 1776. There is a widely praised book by a fellow by the name of McPherson called America's Second Revolution, which is about the Civil War, painting Abraham Lincoln as a revolutionary, which he was. He didn't start out that way. But by the time the Civil War had started, he was. There's a book by Dan Sisson called The Second American Revolution of 1800, which was the election of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson referred to it as a Second American Revolution. I think it was. In fact, what I would submit to you, back in the early founding days, there were no political parties, and all of the founders, I mean, literally from George Washington to Thomas Jefferson to James Madison to even Patrick Henry, who kind of wanted a theocracy, but, you know, the whole bunch of them were concerned that if a party system ever grew up in America, that we would then become static and rigid, and it would be the death of America. Well, a party system grew up, and here it is. And what has happened instead is that we've continued in our revolutionary tradition. And even the parties themselves have had revolutions within them. The Republican Party, for example, of Ronald Reagan is very different from the Republican Party of Dwight Eisenhower. The Republican Party of today is very different from the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan. There have been two revolutions in the Republican Party in my lifetime. Similarly, the Democratic Party before FDR was the party of the South, the party of segregation, the party of, you know, basically kind of the old guard. They got their butts handed to them by the Republicans during the Civil War and in Reconstruction. The Republicans were the progressives, Teddy Roosevelt, fighting Bob La Follette. I mean, it's the Republicans throughout the 19th, end of the 19th century, they were the progressives. And in 1934, Franklin Roosevelt created a revolution not only in America but within the Democratic Party. So we had a genuine revolution in 32. When FDR was elected, I said 34, I meant 32. A genuine revolution when FDR was elected. A genuine revolution when Ronald Reagan was elected. America radically shifted direction. FDR didn't come in and say, oh, you know, well, maybe I can work with these Republicans. Instead, he said, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. Ronald Reagan didn't come in and say, well, maybe I can work with these unions. He said, you show up for work on Monday or you're all fired and I'm going to dissolve your damn union. And he did. These were revolutions. And the election of 2008 was a revolutionary election. Here's President Obama speaking 5 days before the election. You tell me this was not a call for revolution.
From fundamentally transforming the United States of America. In 5 days, you can turn the page on policies that put greed and irresponsibility on Wall Street before the hard work and sacrifice of folks on Main Street. In 5 days, you can choose policies that invest in our middle class and create new jobs and grow this economy so that everyone has a chance to succeed. Folks who can't pay their medical bills, or send their kids to college, or you not being able to afford college, or thinking about that $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 worth of debt that you might have to carry. People who can't save for retirement. You know, ordinary Americans, we can't take a back seat to CEOs and Wall Street banks for 4 more years. But remember, we faced difficult times before. The American story has never been about things coming easy. It's been about rising to the moment when times are tough. Some of you may be cynical and fed up with politics, and you have every right to be. But despite all of this, I ask of you what's been asked of Americans throughout our history. If you'll stand with me and fight by my side and cast your ballot for me, I promise you this, we will not just win Missouri. We will win this general election, and together we will change this country. And we will change the world. Thank you.
We will change this country and we will change the world. That was a call for revolution. And the election of 2008 and the year of 2009, or the years of 2009 and 2010, were fundamentally revolutionary years. This was one of those moments in time where the people of America, frankly, of both parties, were saying, okay, we're ready for a revolution. And, you know, to some extent, there was some revolutionary activity. The House of Representatives passed some brilliant legislation that was truly revolutionary, particularly in the area of trade. Nancy Pelosi did a great job. But the sense of the American people at this moment is that that revolution didn't happen, that the powers on Wall Street are still in charge. We know now from Ron Suskind's book that the president asked Tim Geithner to put together a plan to break up Citibank. Tim Geithner never got around to it. He thought, I know more than this guy. The president was pretty PO'd about that. He surrounded himself with old Clinton folks who were not revolutionaries. Many had been at one point, but they were not now. I mean, they're the establishment, as it were. So the question is, will President Obama, he's starting now again to use revolutionary rhetoric, and I mean this in the nonviolent sense, in the sense that the Reagan revolution, the FDR revolution, the Teddy Roosevelt revolution, the Grover Cleveland revolution, the Abraham Lincoln revolution, the Andrew Jackson revolution, his was against the banks, and the Thomas Jefferson and the George Washington revolutions. Will he use that revolutionary rhetoric?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And perhaps more importantly, will he become a revolutionary? Liz Shuler's next. When 23,000 nurses were locked out of work, a patient died. We need our labor back to work.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast on as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. Liz Shuler is with us. She is back with us, actually. She is the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org, of course, their website. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on the show.
Great to have you with us. You have a gig coming up. I want to talk to you about the what happened with this nurses' strike out of the West Coast and just, you know, the general state of labor. But first, you've got a gig coming up in Minnesota.
Yes, we are so excited.
Tell us about this.
We're expecting almost 800 young workers to converge in Minneapolis beginning on Thursday through the weekend. It's going to be a summit of not only young union members, but also young people from progressive organizations, student groups, just young progressives from all across the country. And we are so excited because this is a time where we need their energy and enthusiasm.
That's spectacular. So this is, you know, labor reaching out to young people who are not members of organized labor. Do I have that right?
That's correct. We'll have young trade unionists as well as young workers from all across the country really forming partnerships because, as you know, what we saw in Wisconsin in the spring was actually a sign of young people taking charge and really leading the way in terms of the debate in this country on good jobs and collective bargaining and really how to get the economy started again.
Now, Rick Scott down in Florida yesterday was bragging about how he's laid off 15,000 government employees, and everybody in the crowd applauded. It seems to me that probably these governors who are going after government employees would not be so aggressive in going after their own employees if they weren't unionized. Do you think or is that just a conspiracy theory on my part?
No, I mean, when I hear something like that, I think, what is there to be proud of in killing jobs? I mean, we need to start talking more about how we're creating jobs should be the number one priority on everyone's mind. So union or non-union, and frankly, the labor movement has been the strongest voice out there in trying to get policymakers to focus on this. I mean, if we learned anything in the last election, it was, hey, our country is concerned about unemployment and the lack of good jobs. So I don't know when they're going to wake up, but we're continuing to fight.
Okay. And apropos of good jobs and essential good jobs, out in California, the one of the nurses' unions went on strike, just a one-day action, Thursday of last week. When they came back on Friday to work, and this was in two hospitals, one was Kaiser Permanente, the other was Sutter Health. When they came back to work on Friday, they were locked out. And one or both of these hospitals, you can correct me if I have any of the details wrong on this, hired scab nurses, I guess you'd call them, or other nurses, temporary nurses, to fill in for them. And a patient died because that patient was given the wrong medication, presumably by some, well, who knows by what. I will just let that stand.
Right.
And where is this going, and what does this demonstrate about the state of labor and labor relations and the future of organized labor?
Well, I think the nurses' strike, and there have been a number going on across the country in terms of public actions designed to really raise public awareness to the important issues of quality care and, you know, not just, and this isn't just a union issue, it's in terms of, you know, are these jobs hiring or hospitals hiring people who are qualified, who have patient loads, who are manageable, and to provide the quality care that the patients really need. So I think the nurses union has been very effective at raising those issues, getting them in the public debate. The issue of quality jobs is certainly on their minds, as well as the labor movement as a whole. So I think that's just one indication of the debate that we really need to be focusing on, is what kind of a country do we want to live in? Do we want a country that continues to outsource and shed good paying jobs and replacing them with low wage jobs and you know, threatening this economy?
Well, and to a large extent, isn't this the Republican message that look at these union workers? They're making more than you are, you who work at Burger King. Or who have Burger King wages and maybe a new hire at GM at $14 an hour, whatever. Look at these union workers who are making a living wage. Actually, you can raise a family on this wage.
What a concept,
how dare
right?
they, you know? And this race to the bottom, I don't get how they are selling this to average working people. You know, the left just took over the French Senate yesterday, first time in 50 years. And I was reading the article, and do you know where their base is of the left? It's in the rural countryside and the small towns.
Right.
And it's like that's where in the United States you've got the Reagan Bush, people who haven't figured it out yet, and in France they figured it out. Maybe it's just because in the rural areas of America, Fox News is the major source of information, but I just don't get it.
I agree. It's a mystery to us why working people continue to ignore their own economic interests when it comes to politics. But we're working on that. We're actually at the AFL-CIO looking to build a permanent infrastructure that will elevate worker power, not the power of any particular party. So our mission is to really educate working people on the notion of quality jobs and, preserving retirement security and health care benefits and the things that people need to survive and to raise their families on. So I think it's a good point you make. It's the billion-dollar question, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe even the trillion-dollar question.
Liz, we talk in terms of billions and trillions in D.C., right?
There you go, yeah. That's the disease of the city.
Yeah.
Liz Schuler, the Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org. Just one more time, the event in Minneapolis, it's in Minneapolis, right?
Minnesota. Correct, Minneapolis, Minnesota, beginning on Thursday. We call it our Next Up Young Workers Summit, and we're going to be training young leaders, giving them the opportunity to really come together and express their concerns and their voices on how we build a just economy.
Great. And people who may want to participate, is there a special website for that, or just go to AFL-CIO.org?
AFLCIO.org, but also nextstepsummit.com.
Nextstepsummit.com.
Next up.
Liz,
summit.
Oh, next up.
Yes.
NEXTUPSummit.org.
Thank you. Or dot org or dot com?
Dot com. Boy, there's so many different dots. Thank you, Liz. Thanks for the great work you're doing. Great talking with you today. And thanks so much for joining us. We need so much more of this in the United States. It is just spectacular. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Brian in Fall River, Massachusetts. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great show like usual, and I love the direction you're moving in. But the only difference is we have a small disagreement, a very small one. There's not a movement right now toward revolution. It's a movement toward revision, the attempt to revise the system to make it workable for the owners. The real contradiction in the system isn't apparent yet. Obviously, in France and other places in the world, the contradiction between living under a capitalist system where the owners have only one goal, and that's to maximize the exploitation of all others. That's all that's in their minds. And you're seeing that reflected very, very poignantly in America right now, how the capitalists have gone global. They don't care about the American workers. All they care about is maximizing profit. Their propaganda and their rhetoric expressed through the Republican Party in America is let them die.
Brian, you're making my point. And last week, last Friday, as the people were in the park in New York City protesting Wall Street, and they're still there, and there was some horrific stuff that happened over the weekend with regard to them, being beat up and dragged off and whatnot. And we're going to be getting into that as in our third hour, in fact, at some length. That the banksters went out on the balconies of some of the Wall Street offices and drank champagne to toast them, right? I mean, this is like, up yours, that's that kind of response. But my point in the last half hour, and probably apropos of what you were saying, was that we had this revolutionary moment for the first couple, and actually enough of the House and Senate that something could have been done for the first couple of years of the Obama administration, and we missed it. And I don't want to lay this entirely at President Obama's feet. The Democratic Party missed it. Much of the Democratic Party missed it. The people went back to sleep thinking Obama would just take care of this from here on forward, and he missed it. And the question in my mind is, can we, and I don't know the answer to this, can we, over the next 14 months, push this nation in a revolutionary direction, again, using that word in the nonviolent context, in the Reagan Revolution, the FDR, the New Deal Revolution, the Square Deal Revolution context? Can we push our politicians, including our president, particularly our president, in a revolutionary direction so that if he wins the election of 2012, he will become that transformational president in 2013 that he promised us in 2008 he would be in 2009?
Nicely. Extremely well stated, but more important, the really negative, the terrible thing here is that people like yourself and myself, I'm a spiritual Marxist, I don't believe that violence is the way to have that revolution.
Yeah, neither do I, and that's why I'm saying nonviolent revolution. I'm saying thank you very much for the call, by the way, Brian. That what Reagan did was a revolution. What Franklin Roosevelt did was a revolution. Neither one of them fired a shot. And we need another revolution like
You're
that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So is this a revolutionary moment in America? Is that what we're leading into? Or is this simply an evolutionary or a tweaking moment? Let's just tweak it around the margins.
It'll come true.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, here's my central premise, that America is a nation birthed in revolution, that when Thomas Jefferson said every generation, every 20 to 30 years, that we should basically revise the Constitution, what he was saying that in the context of a time when political parties didn't exist, and saying times will change, the country will change, although there will be constitutional principles that we will always hold to. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we the people, that kind of stuff. And that we have been through a series of revolutions. The first revolution was in 1776, led to the George Washington presidency. The second, and then George Washington, then John Adams became president. And John Adams was a high Federalist. He was basically taking us back in the direction of Royal England. And Thomas Jefferson led the crusade for the second American Revolution, which was in 1800, the election of 1800, when Jefferson beat Adams and became president of the United States. And the third American Revolution, arguably, was Zachary Taylor, running on the campaign of, I'm going to break up the big American banks, and did in the 1830s. I'm not much of a scholar of that era and time, so please forgive me if I have dates wrong, but it was right around in there. The fourth American Revolution was around Lincoln's time. Lincoln started out, when he became president, his first step was to say to the other side, as it were, to the border states, let's just step by step get rid of slavery. We'll do it gradually over the next 10 or 20 years, and we will repay the slave owners for their freed slaves. And the border states said, screw you, we're not going to do this. And next thing you know, Lincoln had a full-blown civil war on his hand. He issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which excluded those states which had not declared their separation from the Union. And President Obama cites that as a great compromise. I don't think it's a compromise at all, because basically he said to those states who had told him, hey, we're out of here, he said to them, in your face, buddy, I'm declaring war on you. Doesn't sound like a compromise to me. And then you had the revolution of Teddy Roosevelt's presidency, the Progressive Revolution, and then you had the revolution of, arguably after World War II, of Harding's presidency, taking us back to the dynasties. The Gilded Age back. And Harding and Coolidge and Hoover, those three presidents, led right to the Great Depression. And then you had the revolution of FDR, the New Deal, and then you had the revolution of you could argue that there was a revolution in the middle there with Nixon and LBJ, but let's skip over that. I don't think it was that revolutionary. Then you had the revolution of Ronald Reagan, and now it's time for the counter-revolution. And Obama campaigned as a revolutionary, but was not a revolutionary president the first couple of years. And the question, I think, is he going to figure that out? That these are revolutionary times, that what he campaigned on, actually breaking up and changing the banks, what, according to Ron Perlstein's books, he told Tim Geithner to do, and Tim Geithner refused. That what he campaigned on, fundamentally transforming America, has not happened. And still must happen. And the American people want a revolution. And that's why they're showing up at Tea Party events with the old revolutionary flags. Misguided though they may be on, which side is going to be the best revolution for them, they want one. Or will Obama become that revolutionary? So anyhow, Tom in Springfield, Mass. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
First time caller.
Thank you.
I was listening to you speak to the woman from the AFL-CIO. I'm sorry, I missed her name. And your final was wondering why the French rural people are leftists, whereas they don't seem to be in the U.S.
Right.
And I think, my thought anyway, is that this is connected to the American cliche of individualism, that the rural people have been so co-opted by the Tea Party because somehow fundamentally they believe that they're going to become the ruling class.
In America.
The American dream. Yes.
Yeah.
They think that the American dream is feasible for them, and they therefore don't want to hear about, we'll tax the rich and so on, because even though they're not rich, they imagine that they
I don't know how some
rich.
Guy living in a mobile home who makes a living sharpening chainsaw blades and maybe lives on $21,000 a year could ever think that unless it's based
it
on the assumption that he might win the lottery.
It seems as though some of them do. I've known people like this.
Yeah.
I have too.
That's why I used that example. I was one of my neighbors in Vermont.
Yes, and that's similar to where we are here. And I think that long tradition of American individualism doesn't exist in France. They've had collectivist ideas there for a long time.
Well, and the rural people remember the kings and the kingdoms, and
right,
they were always the
right.
victims
I mean,
of the kings and the kingdoms.
They don't literally remember, but yes, that's right. They're less ignorant of history than we are here. And I feel that that's the American left's task in some way, is to get people to have that understanding of how it really is. They're not going to become the ruling class, and that's okay. They don't need to.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting point. Excellent point. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you, Will. From is this another Will?
Hey. Yeah. Hi, Tom. It's Will from Blakesley. How are you?
Hey, good. What's up?
I think the question is whether or not we are sitting on a potential new revolution. I say no doubt about it, and here's why I think it's not only the obvious, you know, but we know what's going on with
you've
the virus.
50 seconds here, quickly.
Okay. I work for a big American company. I don't want to say which one it is. I work in an office. I'm doing pretty well, actually. I work with people in suits, you know, in a business environment.
Right.
But this kind of revolutionary talk is simmering constantly, 24/7, with people that are doing pretty well. It's not just confined to people that are unemployed or working for Walmart or really, really suffering. It's all
right.
over the place. It's really totally mainstream. And
right.
I think that that's kind of what happened during the Vietnam days when you had grandmothers and grandfathers and parents saying enough of this garbage.
Yeah, that's where I said, you know, I almost said the LBJ Nixon revolution, but it would have required some explanation. Probably the best way to say it would be the anti-Vietnam War revolution, because that was a revolutionary time. And that led to a constitutional amendment to allow 18-year-olds to vote. Well said. Thanks. Up next, are we becoming a nation of psychopaths?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In our previous hour, we went through the question, is this a revolutionary moment? Played some clips from President Obama campaigning for president in 2008 as a revolutionary. And I use that word in terms of the Reagan Revolution, the anti-war revolution in the 1960s, the New Deal Revolution in the 1930s, the Teddy Roosevelt Revolution, the Square Deal Revolution, the Progressive Revolution. Was 2008, 2009 a revolutionary moment that got missed? And will it come around again? We're going to come back to that. There's a lot in the news that we're going to get to. It looks like the Republicans in the House have just, you know, gone on vacation and said to the Senate, well, we're going to play chicken. It's a high wire chicken act. We'll get into that. I'll give you the details on that. But first, Seton Motley is on the line with us, the president of Less Government. His Twitter is at Seton Motley, Setonmotley. And Seton, welcome back to the program.
Greetings, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better, Seton. I hope the same is true of you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Sociopaths or psychopaths, actually, let's stick with sociopaths. Sociopaths are defined as people who are incapable of experiencing empathy for others. They view other people as objects on a chessboard, as things to manipulate in their universe, but they themselves don't actually feel the feelings of other people. They feel their own feelings, sometimes in very exaggerated ways. They think that they are the center of the entire universe. And they're about 5% of the population, generally speaking, although according to the Financial Times, among bankers and traders, it's probably a majority of them. But in any case, the question that I want to ask you, listen, this is a gay military guy asking a question in the Republican debate. Here he is.
Do you intend to circumvent the progress that's been made for gay and lesbian soldiers in the military?
Yeah.
Okay, so question number one, are those people sociopaths?
No, they're booing the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They're not booing the guy.
That's
been a total lie that's been made up about that clip.
Okay.
They're not booing the soldier. They're booing the subject matter of his question.
Okay, so they're booing gay people, basically. Okay, so here's Rick Perry being asked about executions.
Your state has executed 234 death row inmates, more than any other governor in modern times. Have you...
Are those people applauding sociopaths?
No. They're if only the Democrat Party at a debate had the balls to say you're in favor of a policy that's aborted 20 million human beings.
Well, unfortunately, there is no Democrat Party in the United States. It's the Democratic Party. But there is no Democrat Party. It's the Democratic Party. I know
that's an adjective. You're supposed to use a noun and that.
The official name of the party, Seton, is the Democratic Party. I know that you guys like to drop the ick because it makes it sound like democratic, and that sounds like a good word, and also the Democrat sounds like rat. I got that. I read Frank Luntz's memo on that from a few years back. Here's a guy. This is a question that was put to Ron Paul. Excuse me. Here we go.
Are you saying the society should just let him die?
No.
Yeah, just let him die. Sociopaths?
Answer my question. Why aren't the Democrats applauding 20 million aborted babies?
I haven't heard any applause for that. Here is Rick Scott talking about laying off government workers.
We have 15,000 less government jobs in the state of Florida.
Now, I'll tell you, Seton, in answer to your question, because you're probably going to persist and keep asking it, Democratic audience applaud 15,000 or 15 million abortions or anything like that, I would say those are probably sociopaths too. I have never heard that in my entire life, and I've been around Democratic politics for a long, long time.
Because they're ashamed of their policy.
And you and I both know it. Nobody applauds abortions. Nobody applauds abortions. People are applauding letting people die. They're applauding executing people, and they're applauding people being fired. Tell me that the Republican base. And that some of the Republican candidates are not sociopaths.
Let's take them piecemeal. Firing government workers is a huge step towards economic recovery. No problem there.
That is nonsense. And these are human beings who lost their jobs. How can somebody who has empathy applaud human beings losing their jobs?
Because it's better for the you always talk about the bigger, broader good. It's better for the bigger, broader good, and we recognize that.
Reducing the number of people who are getting wages and benefits. That's good. That's good for America.
But they're getting it on the backs of other people, Tom. They're leeches.
They're leeches.
They're
teachers,
leeches.
Doctors.
By definition, firefighters.
They don't create anything. They're leeches, right?
They don't create. Government is a black hole.
Firefighters are leeches. Police officers are leeches. Our judiciary system, they're leeches, right? Our judges, they're all leeches.
By definition, are they creating wealth or are they leeching off somebody else's wealth?
They are creating a society in which it is possible for people to create wealth. See, it's very, very simple. If you are one of the people who is creating a society in which it is possible to create wealth, then by my definition, you're not a leech. You're part of, you know, do you think that the NFL referees are leeches?
No, Tom. What about the 800,000 non-essential federal employees?
Do you think that the NFL referees are leeches?
No, because they're part of a system that creates wealth.
They're part of a system that allows players to play.
No, it's part. The NFL is a self-contained unit that creates a lot of wealth. The government is not.
The NFL is a socialist analogy, institution. Tom. You realize.
What?
It's a socialist institution.
It creates wealth, Tom. Therefore, by definition, it's not a socialist institution.
The NFL is very socialist. In fact, they say every year the first pick goes to the people who were the least successful last time around. Tell me that's not socialist.
At the end of the day, it creates wealth, which no socialist entity does. Therefore, you're wrong. Go ahead.
So if we had no court system, no police, no fire system, none of the leeches.
Once again, answer my question. What about firing the 800,000 non-essential personnel at the federal level as defined by the federal government? Let's fire them. They're non-essential by the government's definition. Let's fire them.
Among those people are the people who are working at the Social Security Administration. I would say if you're on Social Security, you would consider them essential.
But the government doesn't consider them essential.
The definition of essential is capable of dealing with an emergency or capable of dealing with a disaster. Come on,
Tom. So. Their employers consider them non-essential.
That's a legal phrase.
What?
Seton, that's a legal phrase. The judges are considered non-essential employees.
Their job. It's an assessment of their job. They're non-essential personnel. Let's get rid of them.
You have dragged us off into this little cul-de-sac that has nothing to do with the larger issue, which I'm asking you about, which is tell me why applauding the death penalty, applauding, you know, booing a guy who's gay.
Applauding is gay, is, Tom. That's a lie. You're lying. Right? They booed "Don't Ask, Don't Tell" being repealed. Don't lie.
You were there.
Yes.
You talked to some of the people who booed.
No, they were told booing you the issue. They talked to. They were a bunch of interviews with people. They said we weren't booing the soldier. We were booing the repeal of "Don't Ask, Don't Tell." There were several interviews with people after the event.
Yeah,
stop making stuff up, Tom. I know you're running out of things.
I am not.
So stop making stuff up.
Okay, let's hear that again. That Jacob, the gay soldier. You tell me how this sounds.
Do you intend to circumvent the progress that's been made for gay and lesbian soldiers in the military?
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you a question, Tom. Did they start booing when he said, "I'm a soldier"? No, they did not. Did they start booing when he said, "I'm a gay soldier"? No, they did not. They didn't start booing until he said he wanted the repeal of "Don't Ask, Don't Tell."
Right, so they were booing.
So they were not booing him. They didn't boo the fact that he was a gay soldier. They booed the fact that he wants to maintain the repeal of "Don't Ask, Don't Tell."
Right, that he wants there to be gays able to be openly gay. So they were booing gays in the military.
They're going, yes, openly gay in the military. Absolutely.
Right.
They want "Don't Ask, Don't Tell"
okay.
Tell back.
So I think you made my case. They are sociopaths. They have no ability to empathize
out
with those people.
Cloth. The
clearly.
Leftist mantra, out of whole cloth.
Seton Motley, less government. Twitter, @ Seton Motley. Thanks, Seton. Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Is this a revolutionary moment in time? Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Martha Kuhl is a registered nurse and the secretary treasurer of National Nurses United, a 29-year nurse at Children's Hospital Oakland, one of the nurses on strike last Thursday who showed up for work on Friday and was told, "No, sorry, you're locked out." Martha, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The website, by the way, nationalnursesunited.org. Martha, tell us what happened last week.
Well, nurses all over the Bay Area at Sutter Hospitals, Kaiser Hospitals, and Children's Hospital Oakland struck for one day from 7 a.m. Thursday morning to 7 a.m. Friday morning. When we attempted to return to work Friday morning, we were locked out. I was with a group of nurses who were scheduled at 7 a.m. Friday morning. I wasn't scheduled till 3, but those 7 a.m. nurses were turned away at the door by hospital security and upper management. They were all prepared to work, and we were locked out.
And is that continuing?
That is continuing. I'm still locked out. I'm scheduled to work at 3 today. We've made sure that management knows we're still available. The same thing is happening for the Sutter nurses nearby at Alta Bates Summit Medical Center, but it isn't happening for 17,000 Kaiser nurses who struck in sympathy on Thursday. They're all back at work.
So they're back at work.
We know it's possible for the employers not to lock us out and that this is a punitive and now horribly tragic event that they're
right.
continuing to
and,
lock
and,
us out.
And the tragedy was?
The tragedy is there was a patient death. It's been reported in the newspapers there was a patient death while under the care of a replacement nurse. And first and foremost, nurses' hearts go out to the family. We offer them our condolences, and we really wish we had been there to help take care of their loved one.
And this patient died, apparently was given the wrong medication. Is this the kind of thing that would happen if a nurse came in, even a good nurse, came into a situation where there was just a lot going on and they had a hard time catching up and they weren't familiar with what was procedures and things? Do you think that's what happened? Or?
Well, that's part of it. We don't know all the details, but
right.
absolutely, a nurse needs to be familiar with her unit, with her coworkers, with her equipment, with her patients, with the policies and procedures.
Right.
And nurses who work in facilities like my unit, we get a significant amount of training before we work on our own, and we always work with a group of nurses who share our skills, and we can back each other up.
So,
in this case, there was a replacement nurse who had none of those abilities, wasn't familiar with the facility, didn't know the equipment, and unfortunately made a grave error.
Right. And what were you striking for?
At Sutter Hospitals, nurses are facing over 200 takeaways. In particular, they're having, management wants to roll back their ability to advocate for our patients, and that's nurses' number one issues. Some of those same issues are on the table at my hospital, at Children's. We're attempting to achieve some patient advocacy standards, and we're also facing severe reductions in health care. We would not be able to bring our own children to Children's, and nurses don't like that.
Would not be able to. What do you mean?
They would make it prohibitively expensive. We would be paying well over $4,000 a year in addition to other health care.
Oh, in other words, they're dialing back your health insurance program to the point where basically you can't afford to get sick and or have your own kids get sick.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And thus use your own hospital or any other hospital, presumably. And so, Martha, do you think that this continuing lockout is an attempt to bust the union?
I think this lockout is unnecessary, unwarranted, and it's an attempt to punish nurses for standing up for our patients' rights. It's very unfortunate. With nurses who are qualified at the door of the hospitals, we should be back there. And we have demanded that they return us. We had a candlelight vigil last night where we offered our condolences to the family and demanded that the employers return us to work. Nurses are present. I'm in my scrubs today because I'm scheduled to work at 3 and hoping to go in. But so far, there's been no word from any of the employers on this lockout.
Are any of these hospitals privately owned, or are any of them state or county owned? Are they private or public hospitals?
They're all private hospitals. They're private, so-called not-for-profit. But these days, even the private not-for-profits make significant amounts of money. Sutter, I don't have the figures at my fingertip, but Sutter is doing quite well financially and has no need to do any of what they're trying to do.
So why do they do it?
For profit.
Yeah.
Nurses stand between our ability to advocate for our patients is what we do daily. That's our number one issue. And we stand between a patient and our employers in many cases. Our job is to take care of the patients, and in their mind, their job is to continue their corporation and make money off of patient care.
There have been so many fortunes made in America taking nonprofit and community hospitals for profit. Bill Frist's family made billions with a B.
Yes, he did, didn't he?
Doing exactly that. I don't want to get you speculating about things that neither one of us know about. What can people do to stand with you at NationalNursesUnited.org?
People can write letters to our CEOs, to the employers, and demand that they not roll back patient protection rights. They could go to our website and get more information. They could contact their legislators and demand that the legislators pay attention to these issues. In fact, we've had a pretty good Bay Area delegation, I have to say. They've been standing with us on these issues. But in other areas, and our website again, it's NationalNursesUnited.org.
Great, great. Well said. Martha Kuhl, the Secretary-Treasurer of National Nurses United. Martha, keep up the great work.
Okay, thank you so much.
And good luck on this. We'll be keeping track of this. I appreciate you being with us. We'll be back here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Is this the pressure building? Is this a revolutionary time in America? Back with your calls.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? All right.
Exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, it's our full Monty alert. Wiener versus Woody. Yeah, nudists in San Francisco are under attack by a city councilman with an ironic name. Public nudity is common in the Castro District of San Francisco, where as the weather warms up, the naked guys, as they are called, strip down. But City Councilman Scott Weiner is now proposing legislation to restrict the exposure of people's, you know what. Weiner is pushing for a bill to require the city's naked guys to cover public benches and seats before sitting on them and to put some pants on before stepping inside restaurants. He says it's a public health issue. But one notorious nudist in the area, also with an ironic name, Woody Miller, thinks Weiner's proposal is unnecessary. He said, putting something down before you sit down, I think that's common etiquette. You don't need to legislate that. It's right there in the nudist handbook. You don't go anywhere without your towel. Wait, there's a nudist handbook? I'm assuming the towel rule is rule number two in the handbook, right behind no jumping jacks? Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot. So much for our revolutionary moment. Janine in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on AM 1330. Hey, Janine, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I heard you earlier, by the way. I wanted to mention Johnson because, I really take exception to what I took anyway as a casual dismissal of Johnson's Great Society, especially the 89th Congress. Considering we had Medicare, civil rights, voters' rights, Head Start, fair housing, yep, just in 1969, you don't consider that revolutionary?
I do.
Well,
you're
it didn't
right.
sound like that.
No, you're right. I skipped over it, and the reason
but
I skipped
everybody
over
everybody does, and I don't understand that. I even heard a progressive talker the other day refer to Truman's Medicare. And, you know, I really think that in every inner city community in this nation, there should be a statue of Lyndon Johnson. He was a really great president, and that was a revolution.
And it wasn't just in the inner city communities. It was in rural, poor areas. You know, Lyndon Johnson raised more white people out of poverty than black people, simply because there are more white people in poverty than black people. But it was right across the board. Here's why it's so easy to jump over it, and probably why I did, because I absolutely acknowledge everything you're saying about LBJ and particularly that Congress. And that is that those of us who remember that time remember getting CS gassed, getting basically nerve gassed in a demonstration with a whole bunch of people on Grand River Avenue in East Lansing, Michigan, where we were chanting, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" And I think that the Vietnam War and LBJ amping up the Vietnam War to the point where it was a real full-blown war and instituting the draft and sending people off to die after the lie of the Tonkin Gulf resolution, that has so colored, particularly for those of us who remember it well, the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, that it's easy to paper over or maybe at some kind of emotional, deep emotional level, dismiss the other really and truly revolutionary things that happened, many of which didn't come out of Lyndon Johnson. They came out of, and the ground was laid for them by Jack and Robert Kennedy.
Absolutely, in terms of civil rights and the tax cut bill. Those were bills that were just languishing in Congress at the time of the president's assassination.
But Lyndon Johnson had, and I will absolutely give you this, Lyndon Johnson had made, he had started out as a rural teacher in rural Texas with poor kids, and mostly poor kids of color, and he had made a lifelong commitment to the poor and to poverty. You're absolutely right, Janine. Thank you very much. I will give you, he was a revolutionary. Chris in Highland Lakes, New Jersey. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I think there's been a revolution going on for a few years, but you ever hear the saying the revolution will not be televised?
Yeah.
I mean, you know as well as I do that the media is run by a bunch of corporations, and in my opinion, both sides are the same. They all work for corporations one way or another. And I believe the revolution has been with Ron Paul for a while, and I know you don't agree with him, but I think there's a very big misconception about the things you say. And you did it before. It was kind of flagrant propaganda when you were kind of putting it on the Republicans booing about, saying, yeah, about the guy dying. You didn't play all of Ron Paul's response, and he actually said, no, that wouldn't be the case. And I think there's a misconception that...
Right, he said, no, actually, that wouldn't be the case because we should just have charity, and doctors would just do it out of the goodness of their heart, and that didn't happen back when he was young. And the fact of the matter is that that happened all the time back when he was young. It just happened in poor communities and in neighborhoods of color, which he was absolutely unaware of.
I think there's a big misconception that if we get rid of a lot of these federal programs that there's going to be nothing to replace them. I mean, you went from Vermont to Oregon to now you're in Washington, D.C., because it's a beast. The federal government is a beast, and we should have more power in the state.
The federal government, Steve, is the creation of a group of revolutionaries who created a government of, by, and for the people. The corporations that have taken over large political chunks of this government are the beast driving the beast, and that's what nobody is going to tell you. And that's what Ron Paul's not going to tell you, because he's all in favor of the transnational corporations running the show. And his son Rand Paul's all in favor of and takes a lot of money from the corporations running the show. And that's what they're not going to tell you. And that's where libertarian philosophy breaks down. That's where Ayn Rand broke down. It's if you think that the so-called free market is going to save you, then what you are doing is you are turning the commons and the common good and the common wealth over to transnational corporations and very wealthy people. And there's no upside to that. There's absolutely no upside to that. Steve in East Point, Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a letter carrier, and I'm out delivering my route right now. And I just wanted to inform everybody that the letter carriers, along with the clerks, the mail handlers, the rural carriers, tomorrow are going to have rallies in front of every congressional district's local office to either thank the congressman for supporting H.R. 1351 or urge them to sign on to support it. And that would do a lot to get the post office out of the situation they're in right now.
Right. H.R. 1351 presumably undoes this thing that this poison pill that was put in by the Republicans during the Bush administration that says that the post office during a 10-year period has to pay for the pensions of people who are not yet even born?
Well, it's the health benefits of the retired.
Right. I'm sorry. The health benefits of retired postal workers 75 years from now.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
And so I think by doing this, we're showing them that we're everywhere.
Yeah, there you go.
Sort of the revolution you're talking about.
Well, I'm telling you, the reason why they put that poison pill in there is because the second largest single employer in the United States is the U.S. Postal Service behind Walmart, and the Postal Service is unionized. And if they could take down 600,000 union employees in one fell swoop or cut it in half, they are going to do everything they can to make that happen. And that's what's going on, and I'm with you, Steve. Good on you for doing that. Thank you very much. Susan in, is it Wanau, Washington? How do you...
It's Wana. We're wet here. 3 to 5 feet of rainfall annually. We're on
Holy
the way to
cow.
The
So what's up?
Well, some of the reason why not-for-profit hospitals such as Old County Hospitals are so profiteering now is when Hillary was in office, she did two lovely things. And June Gibbs Brown, a federal senator, I believe from Louisiana, stood up against her and said, you are going to make health care costs soar. It's called gain share, but they don't want to talk about it. It's otherwise known as referral. But it's the professional fee for service, what used to be doing my job. I do patient and medical advocacy. Despite being disabled, I'm not going to just sit here and have a pity party. The other part is HIPAA. The privacy that we used to have,
right.
We no longer have.
No, I know. Every time I sign one of those forms, I cringe.
And the thought that it's all going to be electronic, it's like a bad game of telephone.
Yeah.
I do not have fibromyalgia, yet because there's a bounty on my head, because they're running a clinical trial here in the state of Washington at Valley Hospital in Kent, the doctor running it is going to share $23,000 to $26,000 with another doctor when they help him get a warm body in there. And if I failed with one MAB drug and developed prion's disease, which is mad cow,
right,
and then they made munitions out of it, lovely.
Yeah.
And it's a black market in the Middle East, lovely.
Yeah. This is pretty grim. Susan, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. May in Galesburg, Michigan. Hey, May, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I hope you're doing good today.
I am. What's up?
I just wanted to call about the nurse's statements that she made, and I'm living proof of that they need somebody that knows what they're doing on the floors. When I was pregnant for my daughter, this nurse came in that I'd never had before, and she was checking for the heartbeat. She couldn't find it. She tried for like 10 minutes, and I was panicking. And she went out and got the head nurse, and she came in, and she had the stethoscope upside down.
Oh, my.
because it's a different stethoscope.
Right, yeah. There's one for deep and there's one for surface.
Yes.
One side, yeah.
And my blood pressure went sky high, you know, and everything. So yeah. They do need nurses that know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah, well said. Okay. May, thank you. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. So my question, I've been reading this book, The Second American Revolution of 1800, over the weekend. I spent much of the weekend between that and trying to write my own next book. But I just got sucked into it. I lay in bed for hours last night reading this. And it's about how Jefferson genuinely believed that the election of 1800 was an American Revolution. And that every 20 or 30 years there would be another American Revolution. That the country, in response to changing times and to throw off the attempts of rising wealth, would constantly have revolutions.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I believe that we're at one of those revolutionary moments right now. I'll share some tape of Barack Obama with you a little later on. Up next, Talk Radio News Service 2. And your calls.
For the building was fully surrounded, and the noise outside was the ringing of revolution.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, on the line with us. Victoria, before we get into your news, first of all, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we get into your news, I'm curious. I'm looking at, well, this isn't the page, but is Chris Christie apparently this week is going to be in California. He's going to be in Missouri, and he's going to be in one other state. I don't have the list in front of me. Which is not normally something that the governor of New Jersey would be doing. And over the weekend, Herman Cain won the straw poll down in Florida, and there are a lot of people speculating that it's not because Herman Cain has a lot of Floridian Republicans who love him. It's because they wanted to send the message of, you know, a pox on all their houses, and this is how widely Mitt Romney is disliked by the Republican base. Could it be that Chris Christie is planning on jumping into the race?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. Yes, it could be, but his denials over the past few months, and there have been a lot of denials, have been pretty heartfelt. I mean, one joke was that he would be the only person who would wake up with him at 5:30 on a 15 below zero day in Des Moines would be his wife, not all the people asking him to run, you know, and he's frequently said that it's entire family and they've had family consultation. And he seems to understand what it takes to want to be president and to not want it enough. Having said that, people do put enormous pressure on people. So, you know, and there's an awful lot of East Coast, real establishment Republican money that is uncommitted so far, that's not gone to Romney. As far as we know, we'll know at the end of the week, because that's the end of the third quarter. We don't think it's gone to Perry. It would love to go to Christie. But I don't think that he's there. I just don't.
Yeah, very interesting. Then why is he visiting these three states?
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
The mystery.
Okay.
The mystery.
So to you for your newscast, please.
Well, let's stay on the presidential candidates for a few minutes, because they are, as we get closer, as we lurch inevitably closer towards 2012, they actually do become newsworthy. And notwithstanding Alec Baldwin's wonderful Rick Perry on Saturday Night Live.
Yes, we have clips of that we can share with our audience later.
Fabulous. Well, Rick Perry, as we all know, did not put in a stellar debate performance on Thursday night. And I think that's one of the reasons why Herman Cain did well and won with nearly 40% of the vote in the straw poll in Florida. And when you say 40% of the vote, you don't have a lot of people voting, but nevertheless, it's big. The other thing was that he gave a really rousing speech. Herman Cain did very well in that debate. He also actually has a plan. He has a plan for taxes that I don't know the details of in great detail, but it's the 999 plan. It's a version of the flat tax, and it's 9% for everything.
Yeah.
And primary voters like it, and they like the fact that he's got a plan.
Right. Plus, he keeps promoting the Social Security should be privatized like it was in Chile, and that the banks should be taking a 20% commission off the top like they do in Chile. It appears that nobody told him that Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, I'm not sure if she is at this moment, but that in 2008 she basically started the reprivatization of their Social Security system, because it's been such a disaster since 81 when the dictator Pinochet privatized it. But he's promoting privatization of Social Security, which is popular with the base.
He is, and I think people probably haven't gone into that enough detail yet. Also today, he came out with a very populist point of view, certainly from the point of view of Democrats, which is when he basically said that Tea Party Republicans need to cut it out with regard to the spending bill and the offsets for FEMA, and that, yes, the Tea Party should pick its battles, and that this probably isn't one of them, and that people should get their disaster relief now.
Which raises a question, what are you hearing with your ear to the ground? This is a replay of what happened with the FAA funding. And in the case of the FAA funding, the Republicans sent a toxic bill from the House of Representatives that included, you know, whacking upside the unions, government employee unions, to the Senate. And then the Republicans in the House went on vacation, and the senators were stuck with, you know, they had to pass the thing, and they did. And the exact same thing has happened now. They've sent this legislation with, you know, FEMA being offset by cutting the green cars program, green energy program. Will the Democrats sign off on this, or are they going to throw it back to the House and then just wait for the government to shut down at the end of the week? I mean, what's going to happen?
There is a vote scheduled for 5:30 this afternoon in the Senate to move this thing forward. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, the Democrat, has scheduled a vote. And the bill that is to be voted on, don't forget, the Senate already passed a funding bill. A spending bill.
Right, which the media completely ignores.
It completely ignores, completely forgets. They passed a spending bill with a very generous, I guess, $6.9 billion for FEMA, which was not offset with cuts elsewhere.
Right.
And then the House took it up, which is sort of the opposite, but that's how it happened. So everybody's forgotten that's already happened. So now they're doing it again, and this time he's rewritten the bill so that the assistance for FEMA is dropped from 6.9 to 3.65 to be in line with the House. Everything else is in line with the House. The only thing that isn't is that he has refused to drop the idea of offsets. He will not have FEMA funding paid for with cuts elsewhere. I don't think he cares very much about this car program. I don't know. It's not a lot of money in the overall scheme of the deficit, but they feel that this is a principle. And he, at the moment, he is saying no. But he needs 7 Republicans, and I don't know whether he can get 7 Republicans round to his point of view tonight.
Then if this new kind of compromise bill, shall we say, with the House doesn't pass, as you said, they've already passed a budget bill that they sent to the House. The House has passed a bill that they sent to the Senate. Both are mutually unacceptable to the other bodies. Does that mean what will happen? Who's going to blink first? This is chicken.
This is fascinating, because so far what we've seen is that Harry Reid has blinked. Harry Reid has compromised because he seems to have been afraid that the Democrats are going to be blamed. I don't know, with Obama getting a spine and going out west and talking trash, you get the impression that Harry Reid is getting really ticked off, that Democrats are getting ticked off here. I don't expect this to be over anytime soon, but they've got Rosh Hashanah. They have to get it over soon.
Amazing. Thank you, Victoria.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman Program. Broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations in America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. We've been asking for the last 2 hours, really, the question, is this a revolutionary moment in America? Thomas Jefferson referred to the election of 1800 when he basically took back America from the High Federalists as the Second American Revolution, the Revolution of 1800. The Reagan Revolution has been referred to as a revolution. The Great Society has been referred to as a revolution. The New Deal has been referred to as a revolution. And I would submit that they all actually were. Are we in a revolutionary moment now? Rick Perlstein is with us. His Twitter is Rick Perlstein, P-E-R-L-S-T-E-I-N, and historian, journalist, author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. Rick, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's always great to be with you.
Thank you. You were quoted by Daniel Nassau for the BBC in their news magazine as talking about learned helplessness in America. This is a concept that Marty Seligman came up with years ago and popularized, that, you know, when they shocked these dogs and they didn't have the ability to run away from the shock, over a period of time they stopped trying to run away, even when they were no longer restrained, that they learned how to be helpless. Do you really think that the American people have learned helplessness the way that Marty Seligman's dogs did?
Well, let's hope not. You know, let's hope that we still have a little fight in us left. But, you know, I think some of the symptoms are there. I mean, it's very hard, and this is in a way a rational response, for us to believe that what we do politically has much response among the people who govern us. And I'll just, you know, give as an example, the whole idea of the super committee, which, you know, in addition to being a kind of dastardly way of guaranteeing that we cut programs that the American people actually need, the whole idea of it, the whole idea of having this bipartisan commission that says, you know, well, these are the rules and our hands are tied, basically removes from any kind of popular accountability any congressman.
Right.
You can just say, well, you know, I'm just doing, you know, what I have to do, and it doesn't matter if a million people show up at their doorstep, I can't do anything about it.
Right, and at least, well, it'll be subject to an up or down vote, no filibuster, and at least one member of that, the Gang of 12, is actually retiring. It's genuinely non-responsive, or actually might be responsive to their next employer, which is probably going to be a lobbying shop. Let me play for you a clip of Barack Obama 5 days before the election of 2008.
Okay,
and this is about 25, 30 seconds. It's a mashup, but it's all from one speech in Missouri. Here he is.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America. In 5 days, you can turn the page on policies that put greed and irresponsibility on Wall Street before the hard work and sacrifice of folks on Main Street. In 5 days, you can choose policies that invest in our middle class and create new jobs and grow this economy so that everyone has a chance to succeed. Folks who can't pay their medical bills or send their kids to college, or you not being able to afford college, or thinking about that $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 worth of debt that you might have to carry. People who can't save for retirement. You know, ordinary Americans, we can't take a back seat to CEOs and Wall Street banks for 4 more years. But remember, we faced difficult times before. The American story has never been about things coming easy. It's been about rising to the moment when times are tough. Some of you may be cynical and fed up with politics, and you have every right to be. But despite all of this, I ask of you what's been asked of Americans throughout our history. If you'll stand with me and fight by my side and cast your ballot for me, I promise you this, we will not just win Missouri, we will win this general election, and together we will change this country and we will change the world.
Now, twice in that, Rick, he said, we will change this country. And the second time he said, and we will change the world. That was a call to revolution.
Well, Tom, you know, when you hear Barack Obama dropping his G's, you know, reach for your wallet.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not quite that cynical. Clearly he surrounded himself with people who were anti-revolutionaries. He surrounded himself with the old Clinton crowd who may have been revolutionaries in their day, and may have tried, but by this time and this point in time, they aren't. And
right.
and he became the establishment. And the question, I guess, in my mind, because it is so clear to me that when Americans voted for FDR, they were voting for revolution. In fact, you had the Bonus Army just 9 months before then. You know, Doug MacArthur driving, you know, through with 8 tanks at horseback, whipping and shooting people on the White House lawn all the way down to the Potomac. That in 32 people were calling for revolution. In 68 people, or 64 rather, people, well, actually throughout the 60s, people were calling for revolution. But the, you know, the big revolutions of the Great Society. In 1980, There was enough of America that was calling for revolution, and I think that they were calling for revolution against high interest rates and a stagnant economy and a seemingly impotent president, that the Reagan revolution was real. I mean, he didn't say to the Patco people, maybe I'll compromise with you, okay, please come back to work. He said, you guys are fired. You're out on your butts. And every single one of these revolutionary presidents, and I can take you back, through Lincoln and Andrew Jackson, with his revolution against the banks and Jefferson's revolution of 1800. I would submit to you every single one of those was an American revolution as significant as the revolution of 1776, except they happened in the ballot boxes. And the question is, will America have another revolution?
Well, I think the PATCO, the 1981, firing the air traffic controllers and Reagan is an interesting example, because what we have here is a president promising on the campaign trail transformative change, and whether, you or I like it or not, delivering transformative change. What we saw in that Barack Obama speech is very interesting, because we've been talking in psychological terms, learned helplessness. There's nothing more kind of denuding of kind of the energy that people have, kind of between their ears, the kind of dynamism to get up in the morning and fight, than the idea that they're going to give a politician a chance after deciding that politicians are not worth giving a chance. And that's what happened to so many of us on the campaign trail, especially young people. And to have invested that energy and that hope and that trust in a politician, and then to have that kind of cut off at the knees is very sapping of your will. And so the question is whether, we're going to be able to muster the popular energy to make big changes and go out in the streets and get done what we need to get done. I'm a little cynical about it, because already we have millions and millions of people who've taken the risk, taken the dare that they didn't think that they would be taking with Barack Obama, and finding themselves systematically disappointed. So I'm a little cynical about that. But look, history can turn on a very, very narrow hinge.
Well, I've always said politicians are the people who notice a parade going down the street, and if it's big enough, they jump out in front and with a flag and say, this is my parade. Is it possible that he'll become that revolutionary again, only this time he'll deliver?
Yeah, I mean, no one saw the New Deal coming. No one saw the Russian Revolution coming. No one saw the Civil War coming. They thought that there would be a deal reached for that.
Yep.
So, anything could be coming around the corner. And, once again, as always, Tom, and you know this better than anyone, it's up to us. It's up to your listeners. It's not up to the president. He didn't say, yes, he can. He said, yes, we can.
Yeah. And so we have to shift from circular firing squad mode to wind behind the back, not in an absolutely unquestioning way, but really, really be out there and putting the pressure on. To say, yes, we want real change this time. Thank you very much. Pardon?
He's been changing the past few weeks because of us.
I believe you're right. I absolutely do. I absolutely believe you're right. Rick Perlstein, at Rick Perlstein, his Twitter account. Rick, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, brother. Keep it up.
You too. Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Are we at a revolutionary moment? Have we been kind of in limbo at one for the last 3 years? Will it fulfill? And the revolution starts at the grassroots level, and it doesn't mean pulling out a gun. I'm telling you, we were birthed in a violent revolution, but we have had a series of revolutions in this country ever since, political revolutions, and I believe we're on the verge of another one, if not full-blown in it. Chuck Zlatkin is with us. Speaking of revolutions, the Postal Workers Union has drawn the ire of the Republican Party because, God forbid, they're the second largest employer in the country and they are unionized. We can't have that many unionized workers running around loose. It's a terrible, terrible thing from the Republican point of view. And so they passed this poison pill legislation a few years back saying that the Postal Service must fund the health benefits of retirees 75 years from now, people who haven't even been born yet, which makes absolutely no sense. And the proof that it makes no sense is no other business, no other government agency in the world, to the best of my knowledge, certainly not in the United States, has been asked to do this. And, of course, it's killing the post office. Financially. And the union is pushing back, and some legislators are pushing back. Chuck Zlatkin is with us. He's the legislative and political director of the New York area, Metro Area Postal Union. a member of the American Postal Workers Union, which is APWU, and thus APWU.org, the website, the New York Metro version is nymetro.org, and Chuck Zlatkin, his Twitter is at Chuck, Z-L-A-T-K-I-N. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me back on.
So what? Give us an update. How are things going?
Well, I guess there are positive things and there are negative things. Let's go with the positive. First of all, the Stephen Lynch bill, H.R. 1351, that would basically solve the problems, the manufactured financial crisis of the Postal Service, is now up to 215 co-sponsors, three away from the magic number. 218
wow.
is the majority, and at that point, any of the co-sponsors can put in a petition for discharge, which means it can force the legislation to the floor and circumvent the chair of the House Oversight and Government Committee, Darrell Issa.
Right.
So that's good news. Another good news is tomorrow, in every congressional district in the United States, there's going to be a Save the Postal Service rally at a local district office of the members of Congress. So if people are interested in attending that rally, they can go to SaveAmericasPostalService.org and click on events, and you can find out a rally that's being held near you.
Okay.
So those are good things that are taking place.
Great.
And then thanks to you, Tom, because the first time you spoke to me, I think there were 193 co-sponsors, and I think what you've been able to do to get the story out has been a big help in our fight.
That's marvelous.
The bad news is last week, Darrell Issa, who's made the postal workers the number one enemy of this week, marked up his bill in a subcommittee to try and force it to the floor. And his bill, which is 2309, which we call the Destroy the Postal Service Act, he added a new amendment to it, which was basically to have mandatory retirement for postal workers. Anybody who is eligible to retire, if this legislation went through now, would be forced to retire. And there are many postal workers who are eligible to retire but not able to retire at this point.
Because retirement means a reduction in income.
Well,
and they're still able, and they're still ready to work, ready, willing, and able to work.
Ready, willing, and able to work. And if people, you know, putting kids through college or you know, caring for an elderly parent, it's not exactly the easiest thing to do it on a postal worker's retirement package.
Mm-hmm.
So ISA is hell-bent on pushing this thing through, and what we need to do is show that the postal service is something that people want because it's something they're entitled to have, and it serves a purpose. As we've mentioned before, the people most dependent upon the postal service are the elderly, disabled, poor, and small business owners who can't afford alternatives. Those are the people who need the postal service, but every American is entitled to universal service, and that's what we're fighting for. Because as postal workers, we know if there's service to the people, there'll be jobs for us. This isn't some kind of welfare situation for postal workers. We do a job that's necessary, and that we're out there working for people. That's why we're the highest rated every year in polls, government employee that's trusted most by the American people, because we're out there every day working for them.
Right.
So we're hoping that we're turning the tide, that we'll be able to show that not only this, there is a need for the Postal Service, but this was a manufactured crisis to do the Postal Service in, to create a situation where it would be privatized and
right.
the unions would be broken.
Right, and if it's privatized, A, they get the unions out of there, and B, the check that you get in the mail every month from whatever source it may be, whether it's your dividend check or your Social Security check, might be delivered by a guy who moonlights at the pizza shop and last year was in jail for mail theft. It's just...
Exactly. As I said to you before, Darrell Issa couldn't get a job in the Postal Service because he couldn't pass the vetting process.
Because of his criminal record.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Which is pretty amazing, you know, when you think about it, that Darrell Issa, because of his criminal record, doesn't qualify for a job with the Postal Service, and yet he's the guy who is leading the charge to destroy it. It's absolutely amazing. We're talking with Chuck Zlatkin. Say that again.
Zlatkin, yes.
Zlatkin. And at Chuck Zlatkin, Z-L-A-T-K-I-N, Twitter account, but more to the point, the website that you mentioned, I don't have written down here. Tell me again so that all of our listeners can catch it, and so also that Sue and Louise can write it down, and we can get it in our newsletter and push it out to all our subscribers tonight.
right? It's Save America's, that's plural, America's Postal Service.org. And you go there and click on events, and it will list the rally near you that will be taking place tomorrow between 4 and 5:30 p.m. locally in your area at a district office of your elected congressional representative. We're there either to thank them for signing on as co-sponsors to 1351 and asking them to stay strong, or we're demanding that they join the majority of American people and save the Postal Service. And also to the 24 Republicans who are co-sponsors, we're asking them to stay strong, that they're representing their constituents who need the Postal Service, and not to be intimidated into pulling off being a co-sponsor as we get closer.
Well said, Chuck.
You're
Thank
listening
you.
To the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So get over to that website and check it out. And, of course, APWU.org as well. And coming up next, the good, the bad, the very ugly, and your call. And that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very lithiferously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Johns Hopkins University. Scientists there think they may have discovered the cure for AIDS. According to research published this week, a new treatment method that removes the cellular membrane around the virus, disarms the virus, keeping it from infecting an individual's immune system. This could be huge news for the entire world, as just last year, 33 million people were infected by AIDS, and 1.8 million people die every year due to the virus. In response to the discovery, a molecular biologist at Johns Hopkins University said that science has finally broken the code of AIDS. This, however, so far just in the Petri dish. It's got a long way to go to get to people. The bad. The city of Bay Minette, Alabama. The city has a secret weapon to fight crime. Jesus. Beginning this week, Bay Minette is putting in place Operation Restore Our Community, a program that will give criminals a choice between going to jail for their crimes or going to a church on Sunday for a year. Besides the new program being flat-out unconstitutional, it's also discriminatory. I suppose those who wish not to worship Jesus, like someone who is Jewish or Muslim, is forced to go to jail. Local pastor in the city defended the program, saying, "You show me someone who falls in love with Jesus, and I'll show you a person who won't be a problem to society." I guess the pastor's never heard of George Tiller or Eric Rudolph or Anders Breivik. And the very, very ugly Lindsey Graham. With America still locked in two wars and a number of other covert wars, neocons like Lindsey Graham are beating the drum for another full-out war in Pakistan. After news came out that Pakistan's rogue intelligence agency may be responsible for attacks on Americans in Afghanistan, Graham went on Fox News Sunday to call for military action against Pakistan, saying the U.S. should put all options on the table. Graham continued saying, "If the experts believe that we need to elevate our response, they will have a lot of bipartisan support on Capitol Hill." Right. Because with a nation struggling with a terrible economy and a debt problem, what we really need is another war. One against a nuclear power, for that matter. Maybe we should stop listening to the same guys who got us into these wars in the first place, the neocons like Lindsey Graham. They're very, very ugly. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. A lot in the news. Well, you know, we've covered a lot of this stuff. Rick Scott calling, saying, "Isn't it wonderful that that he's done away with 15,000 jobs in Florida?" Here's Eric. This is, well, actually, rather than going through all these, clip number three here, Rand Paul. I think that this is a great one, Jacob. Because the Koch brothers, their oil company, has actually been charged with dumping literally tons of benzene into rivers. This is Rand Paul, the Republican from Kentucky.
"I don't want to pollute the water. I don't want to pollute streams. If you dump benzene in the stream, I want you to go to jail."
Rand Paul calling for people at the Koch brothers oil company to go to jail, or some variation. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Anyhow, 866-97-THOM. Are we at a revolutionary moment? David in Suffield, Connecticut. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? I'd like to discuss the Constitution was meant to promote a revolution because
yes.
it's a living, breathing document.
Yes. And it has a mechanism for itself to be modified,
yes,
to be amended.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly. And what we need is an amendment to the Constitution to get rid of the lobbyist system.
Yeah, and well, the easy way to do that is to amend. I mean, let's get right to the root. Let's cut the root out. And the root
All
is
right.
the idea that corporations are people and money is speech. We need, and this is where if you go to movetoamend.org, you can sign on to the petition and push this out to your member of Congress
exactly.
and your senators that we need to pass a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech. Period. End of discussion. Or that essentially puts the word natural before the word person in the 14th Amendment, so
Amen.
That it is very clear to everybody, including the idiots on the Supreme Court, that when the 14th Amendment, which freed the slaves after the Civil War, said no person should be denied equal protection under the law, it did not mean no corporation. It meant no human being. Specifically at the time, they were referring to African-American human beings. So, David, I'm spot on
right
with you.
On.
Very, very well said. Thank you very much. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, a couple things. One is with the Postal Service. Ironically, one of the ways of dealing with postal problems, I know there's always going to be this funding thing about the retirement, but in the present situation, one of the big problems is a very large percentage of the workers are working overtime. We could actually hire more postal employees and reduce the cost to the Postal Service because they would fill in those hours of people working overtime.
Interesting, because the people working overtime are getting paid time and a half or some variation.
Or sometimes double time. I mean, they're wow. getting the people I've talked to work for the Postal Service oftentimes are saying, we're just getting loads of money from overtime. And in yeah. some cases, they don't want to work that overtime. Others, they're saying, hey, this is great.
Sure.
But again, they could reduce their costs and take
yeah.
care of the unemployment
this
problem.
This is why, occasionally you'll get one of these viral emails from the Tea Partiers who say, In Acme, Colorado, the little town of whatever, did you know that there's a sheriff's deputy who made $106,000 last year? Well, it turns out the guy's got a $75,000, salary, but, he worked 80 hours a week, so many weeks, put in so much overtime that he ended up with all that money. If they had just hired another person, but the conservatives on the city council said, no, we can't hire more police, we can't afford them. Yeah.
And another thing about leading the revolution, if people just understood, right now we've got all around the world the IMF is pushing for austerity.
Yes.
Well, Dominique Strauss-Kahn just moved out. He was one pushing for austerity before he got, pushed out.
Right.
But here is something showing the elitism of these people. Strauss-Kahn was renting a townhome in New York that was costing $50,000 a month.
Right.
And he's asking countries to go push for austerity, like Greece.
Yeah, and then you had
Lagarde
is talking about that the IMF itself may need to be refunded.
Yeah, $50,000 a month for a townhome? I mean, that's
yeah.
people who can buy houses in parts of the world. That's the cost of a house for.
Yeah, well, in parts of the world, that's the cost of your entire lifetime. I mean, half
yeah.
of the 7 billion people on Earth live on less than $2 a day. Excellent point,
One
Jeff.
One other quick point, if I may. On Friday, I just wanted to say, when you're talking about activism, and you mentioned something about me actually working with Colorado Democrats.
I did.
If you go to my blog post on your website, it explains the whole thing of what I concluded off of working with within the party. There are a lot of placebo efforts people can do, and you work hard, nothing gets done. But right now, if you go to my blog, and it's GEPH is my username there.
Okay.
But if you go to my blog post on your website, you can see it. But one of the key things is run for actual offices. Don't just be an activist. Run for actual offices. Many of the people listening right now are unemployed. And especially go for the lower-end offices, the county clerks, the elections officials, those who implement policy rather than those who set policy.
Well, and when you talk to members of Congress, and I've, living here in D.C., I've talked with far more probably in the last year than I have in my whole entire life. It's amazing how many of them started out literally like Sarah Palin did and like Michelle Bachmann did on the school board.
Yeah.
I mean, they started out literally at the lowest, most close to the ground elected office that was available to them, and then they moved from the school board to the city council, and then they moved from the city council to a county commissioner, and then they moved from county commissioner to state representative, and then they moved from state representative to United States Congress, and they moved from United States. Or Bernie Sanders, he started out as mayor of Burlington. He lost four elections before he finally got elected. And
Obama went from state senator to president in without even finishing the term of each one of those in less than 9 years.
Yeah, that's pretty.
So you need a job, run for office.
There you go. Need a job, run for office. That should be a bumper sticker. Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. Tim in Los Angeles. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, you were talking about how are we in a revolution or is the revolution happening right now? And I know a lot of people are disenfranchised, even though there are people, say, like in New York or Wisconsin or whatever. But there has been a revolution going on that a lot of people aren't talking about. And that revolution is the e-revolution. It's what Anonymous is doing. They shut down HB Federal, Gary Federal. They shut down Visa, MasterCard, PayPal. These geeks managed to take down giant corporations.
Right.
And that's the revolution I'm talking about.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure I would call that a revolution. I would call that symptoms of a revolutionary time.
But they're using technology, though, as for the revolution to take down the corporations.
Yeah, I would say that you know, without endorsing what they're doing, because much of it is illegal, I would still say that kind of behavior, you know, what's going on there, is absolutely symptomatic of the fact that we live in a time that is pregnant with revolution. Tim, well said.
Yep.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Mike in Fort Collins, Colorado. Minute to the break, Mike. What's up?
How you doing today, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good. Long time, first time. We have a Secretary of State out here, Scott Gessler, who's a GOP, and he's trying to, in a roundabout way, disenfranchise people. He's going after the highly Republican county of Denver, and that is that if you got mad, or let's say you were in the hospital or whatever, you did not vote last year, you cannot get a mail-in ballot. You can still vote, but you have to go in and stand in line. And he's trying that in Denver. Denver is boring their back, and the county, Pueblo County, is waiting to see what happens. But you know, if he jams this down Denver's throat, who knows how many secretaries of states over the country will pull the same thing.
I heard this morning there's a concerted nationwide effort to eliminate mail-in ballots and early voting, and as many as 20% of Americans will not have that available to them who did have that available to them 4 years ago. Thank you, Mike.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, the funnies. You can't miss the funnies. Well, maybe not that funny.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And last night, this is Rick Perry, clip number 6. This is Rick Perry, the real Rick Perry, actually trying to successfully debate. Do we have that, Jacob? Okay.
He was before the social programs from the standpoint of he was far standing up for Roe versus Wade, before he was against Roe versus Wade.
Yeah, and here's Alec Baldwin pretending he's Rick Perry on Saturday Night Live.
He was before border control.
And here on Saturday Night Live, I'm sorry, I don't know the actress. This is Michelle Bachman, sort of.
Michelle Bachman.
You know you want it.
How do you rebound from your falling poll numbers?
Shepard, I'm persistent, and when I want something, I won't take no for an answer. Take, for instance, when I first met my husband. We were both at a party, and I saw him across the room acting out all the parts from the musical Grease. Smitten, I asked him out for a hot water and lemon. He said, Miss Thang, here's a quarter. Buy yourself a clue. But I wouldn't give up. Fences, Jesus, papilloma, eyeballs.
There you go. And this is the closing of the SNL GOP debate.
That concludes tonight's debate. As a reminder to Chris Christie, it's wide open, buddy.
Yeah. And Chris Christie, we just learned, is going to be visiting three or four states here this week. That looks to me like a candidate. Tim in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Your question about the revolution.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I believe it's we're at a revolutionary time. I think it's important that Obama, in the course of his getting on the stump and getting a spine, actually, while he's doing it, get a comprehensive effort, cohesive effort between the unions, the government workers, and most importantly, the students in the United States. I think they're a very big missing ingredient today on getting past the media lack of attention.
Yeah.
And I think the three coupled together with Obama's traveling and getting the message out in education will help a revolution, and all the fantasies about change to the amending the Constitution and the cockamamie idea that corporations are people and the like needs to be put out in front of people who will be passionate and out in front and can't be ignored.
Okay, thank you very much. Here's the fourth thing that I would add to that, and that is that President Obama actually needs to walk the talk. He needs to walk the walk that conforms with the talk. And, for example, next month, in all probability, there will be a bill coming out of the Senate putting a tariff on imported goods from countries that manipulate their currencies or that are gaming international trade rules. Back to tariffs. The president should sign it and should, you know, go along with it. We'll see. We'll see. Let's see here. Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
If the government shuts down, what's the odds on the Social Security checks going out? And also, what's the odds of getting a COLA this year? And if you don't get a COLA this year, I think you're going to see a lot of revolution going on.
Yeah, I don't think that there's going to be a COLA this year. I would be surprised by that because we basically have zero inflation. I think we might even be flirting with negative inflation right now, which is that's called a depression. And in terms of whether or not Social Security checks go out, I honestly don't know. But my understanding is that when they shut down the government and they send all the, quote, non-essential workers, end quote, home, the people that Seton Motley was talking about in our debate 2 hours ago, those non-essential workers include people who write checks because that's not essential for the defense of the country. The so-called essential workers are the Secret Service, the FBI, the CIA, the military, things like that, in the definitions of corporate or of government bureaucracy. And so, this would be a big deal. I think it would be a big deal. Larry, thank you for the call. Stephen in Osage Beach, Missouri?
Osage Beach, Missouri.
Osage. Okay. What's up, Stephen?
I just wanted to comment on over those 500,000 people who have been, you know, laid off in the red states. And, you know, I don't know what money they're really saving on it, considering they had to go on unemployment, receive food stamps more than likely, and just so on and so on.
Lose their home, families. No longer pay local property taxes. I mean, you know, Rick Scott lives in an absolute bizarre fantasy world, thinking that by laying off his own employees of his own state, he's going to somehow improve the quality of his state. He's just absolutely nuts. Excellent point, Stephen. Thank you for calling and making it. Jim in Northport, Florida. Hey, Jim, we have a minute to the end of the show. It's all yours.
First of all, thanks for, you know, your efforts to get us involved. I always had a question. Maybe you have the answer concerning our senators and representatives in Washington. How did we end up with the famous 545? That's my first question.
Well, there's 100 senators.
Is it possible to send them back home? I mean, not as punishment, but to be able to, in this day and age, operate electronically and be where we can get a hold of them and perhaps even get a good bite on lobbyism and such, and save a whole lot of money if they were in their state houses.
Okay, a couple quick points. Number one, every state has two senators, so that's 100 out of the 535. And then the rest, the other 435, are a function of the population of the country.
I understand that, but was there ever a bill or something where that had to be done that way?
It's evolved over time. I mean, you know, we start out with very, very few, actually. But the important point is that you were asking the question, is there a way to send them home? Yes, it's called an election. There's one coming up in 13 months, and we need to get ready for it. How can we save the American dream? I'll talk with Bob Borisage, Robert Borisage, coming up tomorrow. Plus, why is network TV suddenly overstuffed with Bucks and Bunnies, sexy stewardesses, and Charlie's Angels? What's the bigger picture here? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. When you show up, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.